get to the back row.
I feel like splash zone. I'm most scared to spit while he talks, but.
Did you ever figure out who took your chair?
No. Do you know the mystery of it yet?
No. Listen, I wasn't worried about it, so I didn't look into it.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think, like, you know, you got running the building here during the day, so I'd scour the whole.
I could, yeah.
Probably.
Somebody else might really need it, though.
To make them feel smart?
Yeah. If somebody got me one of those tweed jackets or whatever with the leather thing, that would replace
the patches.
That would replace the need for my chair. That makes me look sophisticated.
Would you wear it every time?
I would wear it every time in these modern challenges classes where we get philosophical. But when I'm just teaching the Bible, then
you would wear it every time. You're like what, a 38 regular?
30. Oh, my chest? I don't know what that is.
I'm sports coat.
Sports coat. I don't know.
He thought he insulted his.
Yeah, I'd say.
Yeah, no, man. This same pant size since high school.
He's working on his clothing store. I'd say you're 38 regular.
He said 38.
Push it 40.
Look like a 38 regular.
All right. Yeah, go for it.
No, an insult would have been a 38 short.
38 short.
Yeah.
I don't know what any of this means.
Okay.
All right, so we are looking at morality in this class, and I want to do what we normally do. Oh, so here's the updated version of what we're going to be doing in these classes. So these first, I think I'm going to cut out this one on forgiveness, but we're talking about these different needs that human beings have, and we'll frame again why we're talking about that to remind us in just a moment. But I think the approach that everybody wanted to do was do more of the objective evidences for Christianity after we've talked about what I like to call the subjective evidences for Christianity. This approach being in a society that is not really directed by objective facts and data, how do you teach the gospel to somebody in our society today when you can't be like, well, here's the archaeological evidence for the Bible, here's the arguments for the existence of God, here's why the Bible is trustworthy, whatever. If people are not concerned about objective facts and data to determine what they think is right and wrong, but more like, well, does it resonate with me and would it fit my lived experience and stuff like this? What we're doing is talking about different human needs and comparing the secular, or I've been starting to call it more so now the materialistic worldview as opposed to the Christian worldview, and like looking at quotes from both sides and just like laying it out there and saying which thing seems to resonate better with how you think about the world. And it's every time Christianity wins, but we're doing it in a charitable way. So what we're going to do in these classes, we're going to shift from these subjective evidences that should clear away emotional barriers to belief because they actually should want Christianity to be true after they see that it gives them all of these things. Then they're open to the objective, here's the arguments for God, here's the arguments for the Bible, here's God, arguments for the existence of Jesus, and we're going to do some other objective things, and that's going to be the approach for these classes. I'm going to split one of these classes into another one and take away this class on forgiveness. But let's just remind us of what we're doing in these classes. The purpose of what we're doing is to show that Christianity makes better sense of the world, that if your worldview is a materialistic, secular worldview, you're left with a lot of things that don't give you what you know you need. And so we're trying to strengthen our own faith, provide a tool for conversations. We've talked about this every class, and I think it's important to remind ourselves the causes of skepticism. Oftentimes we can think that people are skeptics because they're just really deep academic thinkers. But what's oftentimes behind what appears to be objective reasoning is justification for sin, not for everybody, but for some people. They've had a bad religious experience, and so they can't ever imagine being a Christian again because of this kind of family I grew up in or whatever. But they read all these things from these really smart atheists, and then they present that as their reason, when that's not really the reason. This is what's behind it. Or there's cultural background beliefs. In our society, there's more peer pressure against belief in God, especially if you're going to a college, especially if you're getting a science degree. You're not going to fit in very well if you're open about your faith. Okay, so all of these reasons, as we've talked about, one way that you could boil these down is there's a sense in which all of these are emotion-driven. So the biggest reasons, I think, for skepticism in our society is boiled down to emotional things, not objective thinking. So what we do is we try to show them the emotional appeals to Christianity, that God has all the answers for the things that we know we need. Make sense? So today we're going to be talking about our need for moral grounding, not our need for morality. Because I think, do you guys think atheists can be moral?
Sure.
Can they do morally good things? Yeah. So we're not saying that atheists can't be moral. What we're saying is that atheists don't have good reasons to be moral in their worldview. That's an important distinction to make. So let's start with this question. Before we do that, actually, let's go ahead and start with a word of prayer. McCord, can you do that for us?
Heavenly Father, thank you for this day you've given us. Thank you for allowing us to come here safely and to focus on you and study your word and learn some things that we can apply to our life to grow the faith. Lord, help us to focus and to learn as much as we can. Lord, please be with Eric and help him to present this in a great manner for us to learn. Lord, please be with us and help us keep us safe. In your name, I pray. Amen.
All right. Let us start then with this question: what is moral obligation? And I have this question on the material.
Objective reason to perform a certain act for societal good.
Yeah, an objective reason. Objective meaning that it would be true for all people, right? Like, something that's right or wrong for all people, something that is not applicable only to certain people and times and cultures and things like that. When we talk about moral obligation, everybody might have like moral differences where somebody might go, well, I don't think lying is always wrong. I think it's okay in this situation. And of course, they would be wrong about thinking that way. But there are certain things that even a skeptic or whatever, they would say, well, that's just not right for anybody. Like racism. Like nobody's going to say, well, I think racism is okay for me. But if you're not for racism, then we don't need to fight about it, or vice versa. Like, people would say that's wrong for everyone, and they'd be right about it. Or murder, or rape, or something like that. So, moral obligation would be, there's this sense that everybody has, that there are things that are wrong for all people, across all cultures, no matter what. We've got that kind of intuition within us. So, the question then becomes, with regards to moral obligation, how would the materialistic secular worldview find a grounding or a reason to base that intuition off of? Does that make sense, that question? Okay, do you guys have any comments or questions about that before we start talking about the secular grounding for morality? All right, so whenever I've studied with atheists, one of the things, I started including this first quote here from Julian Baggini. And he's one of the editors of Philosopher's Magazine, and he's like British, and he's a famous atheist, and he writes a lot of stuff. So I used to not use this quote, because whenever I've studied with skeptics, they've thought, well, morality is just common sense, don't hurt people. Like, do we really need to have a discussion about why we think something's right or wrong? And I like this quote that Julian Baggini says here. He says this: anyone who thinks it's easy to ground ethics either hasn't done much moral philosophy or wasn't concentrating when they did. Although morality is arguably just as murky for the religious, at least there is some bedrock belief that gives a reason to believe that morality is real and will prevail. In an atheist universe, morality can be rejected without external sanction at any point and without a clear, compelling reason to believe in its reality. That's exactly what will sometimes happen. All right, how does Julian Baggini discuss the difficulties of grounding ethics here? What reflections do you have about this quote here?
It takes a lot of processing.
Yeah. Like, if you want to boil morality down to common sense or things that everybody knows, then you really have not thought deeply about these questions. Were you going to say something, Ian?
No. All right.
Okay. Anything else about this one? What does he say, if you don't believe in God, what does he say will sometimes happen with somebody's morality or society's morality?
You're rejected at any point.
Yeah, without external sanction. So, like, God is our external sanction for morality. We're going to say more about that later. But if you don't believe in any God that you have to answer to...
Do what's right. Every man does what's right in his own sight.
Right, and yes, like in the book of Judges.
Yeah.
And so he says here that that will sometimes happen, but he says that this is a murky process. So there's Steve Sinnott Williams or something. He wrote a book, and I think the book is just like common sense morality, and he's an atheist who says, guys, why are we having all these philosophical debates about morality? It's just common sense. Well, that is patently not true, because how many debates are there about morality? Should we open up the borders? Should we not open up the borders? Is pornography okay? Is it not? Is it bad? Like, there's different states that have different opinions about these sorts of things. What about legalizing marijuana and different? And people have moral concerns. People will fight over differences in morality. Don't say that this is a common sense issue. So I like that quote to get started. But so then we get into, unless anybody else has anything that they want to say about this. All right, so then we get into some of the approaches that people would have to say, well, I'm an atheist, and this is where I think morality has come from. Number one, morality has come from evolution. Now, I'm curious, how many of you have ever heard somebody say this before? That we got evolution, that we got morality from evolution?
I don't know if it's necessarily the same thing, but like looking more back in history and being like, oh, that's wrong.
Yeah, so we've evolved as in a societal kind of way. Yeah, so that would be one way that maybe people would apply that. This, I'll tell you guys, this is becoming the more common argument that atheists are making right now. And so let me show you one quote from this. Michael Ruse, he said this, he's another atheist. Morality then is something is not something handed down to Moses on Mount Sinai. It is something forged in the struggle for existence and reproduction, something fashioned by natural selection. It is as much a natural human adaptation as our ears or noses or teeth. So what he's saying here is that just like evolution has done things like for our survival, evolution has produced this thing that we think of as value judgments and morality. And things like that. And there's a lot of other quotes we could look at on how they think evolution has accomplished this.
So like circumstances have defined morality.
Circumstances, or what they'll say is the material processes of evolution as the chemicals changed from generation to generation and we evolved as a human species, those synapses in our brains, like, so you got the classic example of the birds with the longer beaks on the islands of the Galapagos Islands. Well, the longer beak ones survived because they were able to eat certain things that the small beak ones couldn't. And the only ones that were therefore mating were the ones that had the longer beaks because they were the ones surviving. And then they passed that gene on to the next generation. By the way, is that true? Yeah, that's true. But does that mean that the bird became a different species of thing? No, it doesn't mean that. But they extrapolate that out. Anyways, they'll say that that the cavemen used to kill each other or whatever. And then like the synapses and the process of evolution has caused us to now be concerned about morality in a way that no other species ever was. One of the cases and points of this would be, you can look at the animal kingdoms. Do you ever see them acting altruistically towards each other? Are there some animals, like do some animals take care of each other? Yeah, but chimpanzees also eat each other. Did you know that? Like, disgusting. So, like, you see some animals that seem to have some care and concern for other ones, and then other ones. So you can observe it in the animal kingdom, and you like the process of evolution eventually got us to the point where humans, the highest things that evolution has produced, we are concerned about this. All right, so here's some problems with this. Thomas Nagel is one of my favorite atheists to read from. He was an NYU professor. He wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos. Now, have we talked about the role of philosophy, classically speaking, as it relates to the sciences? Have we talked about this? Okay, so Thomas Nagel is one of the more classical philosophers, and what the role of philosophy is asking questions and challenging people on metaphysical things that science can't answer. So like science, people that are in the hard sciences think that, well, we'll get an answer to this or that, and science can explain why we have morality, and science can explain all these different sorts of things. And then the philosophers come and they say, are you sure about that? They're not like anti-science, but they're saying, you guys are going a little too far. And so in this book, Mind and Cosmos, what Thomas Nagel is doing is he's punching against the idea that evolution can explain everything that we have. Even though he's not a Christian at all. But look what this quote says. Here's one of the problems with this view. If evolutionary biology is a physical theory, as it is generally taken to be, then it cannot account for the appearance of consciousness and other phenomena that are not physically reducible. All right, let's break this down. What does evolutionary biology being a physical theory mean?
That everything happened through the body.
Everything happened, like, through the body, through synapses in the brain. What else would be meant by physical theory?
That everything can be explained.
It's tangible.
Everything's tangible. Everything can be explained through, like, microscopes, everything. Like, you can see it, right? So, in other words, does evolutionary biology believe in a creator? There's some Christians that I know, actually, that are actual Christians that believe that God used evolution, and I think they're misguided on those things, but I don't want to get into that debate. But evolutionary biology, apart from God using evolution, there's no spirit and soul in man. Everything is just material and physical. So if evolution is a physical theory, how does it account for consciousness, which is an immaterial part of being a human? And he goes on in the book to say, how does it account for moral judgments and morality, which are not physical things? These are immaterial parts of being human. And he's challenging the scientists, and he's going, you guys are trying to say that evolution can explain everything, but you guys can't answer these questions. Does that make sense? So that's one problem with it. A simpler way of saying all of that is, how does a material process create the immaterial consciousness and the immaterial value judgment and morality? Those are immaterial things. Like, for example, if I think of a green banana, it's not like literally popping up in my brain somewhere where if I died thinking about a green banana, a lot of them are green, I don't know, you're supposed to pick an odd color for whatever. Like, you couldn't crack open my skull and find the banana. It's an immaterial thing, but it's attached to my brain. But it's an immaterial part of what's going on in my head. Does that make sense? All right. So that's one problem with this. There's another problem with this answer. Does anybody have anything else to say about that idea that the material can't create immaterial things? All right. Here's another problem with this. The strong eating the weak seems pretty inconsistent with altruism. So, if your worldview says that we came about by the strong eating the weak, the survival of the fittest, we all descended from apes, therefore let us love one another. That doesn't even make sense. And so, I want to be careful in how I bring some of these examples up, because I by no means want to suggest that every evolutionary biologist would believe this. But I think it's important to know historically that evolutionary biology, apart from God using evolution, as some people would say, evolutionary biology historically has not created morality, like good morality. So Charles Darwin, he wrote a really long book called The Descent of Man, and this is Charles Darwin's book on dating, who you should marry. Did you know that he had marriage advice? If you're thinking about getting married, you might want to read this book. But here's what Charles Darwin said. At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. At the same time, the anthropomorphous apes will, notice that phrase, by the way, will no doubt be exterminated. The break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man and a more civilized state, as we may hope. than even than the Caucasian and some ape as low as a baboon, instead of as now between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla. What is he saying here? Yeah.
Survival of the fittest is grounds for race war. And extermination of race is based upon race.
Right. So, like, on the one hand, you got the Caucasian white people that are the most advanced, as he says. And then, like, there's people that are, like, a step behind them. Who are they?
Well, at the time, this was, I think, height of imperialism at the time. So this was all, you know, the European nations are going out and pretty much taking whatever land they can get. And this is kind of, I think, a result of that.
Yeah, the question would be, is Charles Darwin saying this is what ought to happen, or is he saying this mechanism will end up inevitably making this happen? Whether or not he thinks it's a good thing is a different question. He's saying my theory
at some future period,
right, would lead to this happening. So the most advanced are the Caucasians, the people that are a step behind, which he calls anthropomorphous apes here. He goes on at the end to describe them as the Negro, the Australian, and the gorilla. So you've got the Caucasians as the most advanced, the people who are a step behind, the Australians, Negroes, and gorillas. But then there's a step behind those people, and those are like baboons and all these different sorts of things. He's saying that this middle one is going to be wiped out by the more advanced, and then it'll be more clear that the Caucasians are the greatest thing, is his point. Did you guys know that he said that? The Descent of Man is that book. So he's saying in this idea, how can you say that evolution has created morality when one of the guys that really purported these ideologies said, this is what my philosophy or this is what my theory will lead to, because if it can be applied to apes, it can be applied to humans. Tom Holland, not Spider-Man again, but the guy, he wrote, he's a British atheist. He wrote a book called Dominion. I brought it up before. It's a really good book about the influence of Christianity throughout history. But he said this in his book. Hitler's policies, although rooted in the sense of race, is something primordially ancient, were rooted as well in the clinical formulations of evolutionary theory. The measures that would restore purity to the German people were prescribed equally by the ancient chronicles and by Darwinist textbooks. To eliminate those who stood in the way of fulfilling each such a program was not a crime, but a responsibility. Apes massacre all fringe elements as alien to their community. Hitler did not hesitate to draw the logical conclusion, what is valid for monkeys must be all the more valid for humans. So what is Tom Holland saying Charles Darwin's theory of evolution created for the Nazis?
Their sense of morality.
Their sense of morality, which your moral obligation was actually to kill off the weaker species for the greater good of the greater species. Like, what evolutionary biology does, if you try to make moral judgments from it, there's no altruism involved in this unless it's a fellow Caucasian. The only kind of people that you care about are your fellow Caucasians, but you're not going to be concerned about helping those who are inferior to you. Your responsibility actually becomes to kill them. That's what becomes right in that worldview. At least as Hitler applied it. Comments or questions on that?
Just an observation. I mean, and how many atheists that profess to be atheists for some of the emotional reasons that you initially discussed as we opened class have any idea,
right,
of some of the things that are being said about what it is, what it means to be an atheist, what some of these leading,
right,
people in the field believe with regard to that belief.
Right. And this is why getting these kind of quotes, I love collecting quotes. And then, like, next time I do these studies with atheists, I'm like, the new quotes that I have, I'm like rearranging and taking out ones that maybe aren't as good and putting the newer ones in. Like, so I'm trying to refine this as much as I can every time I do it. But there's a lot of people that don't know that Charles Darwin ever said that. But he did. And so I don't know why he doesn't get canceled. All right, anything else you guys want to say on this argument? Morality comes from evolution. Historically, the first thing, the material process can't create an immaterial thing. Number two, the strong eating the weak is inconsistent with altruism, and that's played out in a lot of different ways. Matt?
This point of view is often seen from in terms of like biology evolution, but there's even discussions in terms of politically and social evolution that also suggest that, you know, morality comes from those who are successful within the society, and that comes back from even, you know, your different authors of the state of man in a free, like in an untouched state, the idea of one being naturally evil, one being naturally good, and things along those lines. And Thomas Hobbes, he talks about,
yeah,
in his text, he talks about that the state of man is naturally one of violence against another, and therefore the government must be there in order to protect man against itself.
Didn't he write Leviathan, though?
He did. And that's what he wrote, Leviathan. It's a metaphor for that.
Okay.
But basically the overall thing is, you can sum it up that might makes right.
Right.
Being physically dominant makes you...
But he was social contract theory.
It was before that another...
Oh, really? So he changed his view?
He did both.
Okay. Because I just started reading Thomas Paine's Common Sense this last week. Mm-hmm. And it's a short book. But like, he begins the book by saying government is a necessary evil because of man's wickedness.
That's before even all the... That's...
So Hobbes used to agree with Thomas Paine?
It's a lot. There's a whole lot.
Okay, we just have to get lunch.
Yeah.
All right.
But basically the whole thing is the idea of might makes right. And that's what I think also comes from the idea of evolution, is that if you are in charge, or if you're in power, therefore you are morally correct because you can back up your morals.
Right. Because you're the one. Yeah, eventually, like, in this worldview, morality comes from, if I can punch you out, then I'm right.
Right.
Right. So, okay. All right, so that's the first argument. Morality comes from evolution. No, it don't. Number two, people will say each person can decide morality for him or herself. And so Thomas Deutsch, he wrote the introduction of one of Jordan Peterson's books, and he describes what relativism means. Relative means that there is no absolute right and wrong in anything. Instead, morality and the rules associated with it are just a matter of personal opinion or happenstance, relative to or related to a particular framework such as one's ethnicity, one's upbringing, or the culture or historical moment one is born into. It's nothing but an accident of birth. All right, so here's the question. What problems do you guys see with this approach?
It's not really morality, it's more a person's personal code.
Yeah, your personal law code.
Since as Mr. Jim said, like, each person does what's right in their own eyes. And
right.
So there's, like, just chaos is really the result. Like,
but the thing that's strange is when people say, like, oh, it's whatever is right for you, but until you start harming somebody else. Were you going to say something, Matt?
Yeah, I was going to say, what's right for me might be what's wrong for you.
Right.
And so how can you function with that in mind?
Right. If we start with the idea that we all want to help each other, as long as we don't harm each other. This is the atheists that I've studied with most recently, they've said, yeah, you get to decide morality for yourself as long as you're not harming anybody else. And you go, okay, well, where does that law come from? That we shouldn't harm anybody? Well, it's common sense. So would it be wrong to steal from you? Oh, yeah. Would it be wrong to covet, like, the things that belong to you? Yeah, absolutely. Would it be wrong to murder you? Yeah, for sure. Oh, it sounds like you agree with a lot of what the Bible says. You know, like, you look at the laws in the Old Testament about the Ten Commandments and, like, how you take care of your neighbor's stuff, like... Where did this idea come from that we're not supposed to harm each other? You're just, like, throwing that in and saying it's common sense, but it's not.
And even that idea of, like, well, you can't harm anyone, like, that's relative, too. And so, like, you can't...
Right.
You can't define that either with, like, there's no common ground. Like,
right, if it's relative, then...
What I view as harming someone and what you view as harming someone...
Right.
...is really different, so it just goes on.
And then you have questions on what does harm mean.
Yeah.
So, like, a peeping Tom. Are they harming anybody physically? No, but they're super creepy, and they, you know, so what is harm? We have all kinds of debates about what it even means to harm somebody. Were you going to say something, Lauren?
Yeah, I'm just going to say, like, people try to make it just like, oh, everyone just decides for themselves. But if you think about it, like, it's almost impossible that everyone would agree on certain things if they all just came up with their own ideas.
Yes, right.
So, it's kind of prove themselves wrong.
Right.
It also is kind of saying that in different parts of the world, how you view morality is going to be different. So, like, people in Africa will have a different morality than people here.
Right. Which means, therefore, we don't have the right to criticize Hitler. Yeah, that was a different place. That was a different time. But there's a lot of things we might not have understood about Hitler. Maybe he was, you know, one of the problems in our society right now is to over-psychologize sin. You know, like, oh, that person was a jerk, but, you know, they had a really bad upbringing. Maybe that helps us have compassion on somebody. I'm not against having those discussions. But there's a problem of over-psychologizing sin to the point where we justify what they did. And God, if God says that it's wrong, then it's wrong. Their reasons behind it are their battles that they have to fight, but we don't excuse any sin because we're psychologizing them. So that one, that's pretty, I think we're familiar with that. Here's another one that's kind of similar. Morality comes from social consensus. What time are we at, Jim?
7:30.
Okay, so morality comes from social consensus. This is different from social contract theory, which if we want to get into that, we can, but that gets into a lot more weeds. But social consensus would mean democracy, where 51% of the people believe that this is what's right, and then therefore that's what happens in a nation. So in other words, it's the same thing as moral relativity applied to a whole nation rather than an individual. Does that make sense? So here's a couple problems with that. Here's something that Greg Kokel said about this. He's a Christian apologist. The first serious problem is that it violates our deepest moral intuitions, the foundational assumptions of civilization. Some things seem wrong regardless of what society says, including plundering innocent Jews, pressing them into forced labor, and exterminating them. If there is no law above society, then society cannot be judged. So I like that quote, but here's another thing that he says about it. Moral reformers typically judge society from the inside. They challenge their culture's standard of behavior and then campaign for change. If morality is defined as the present society's standard, though, then challenging that standard would be an act of immorality by definition. Social reformers would not be moral after all, but rather moral outcasts, precisely because they opposed the status quo. Those are good quotes. I don't know what else to say about them. He's a good writer. But do you guys have any thoughts or comments on any of that?
Kind of live under social consensus in some ways. Like you mentioned legalizing marijuana and some of those other issues.
Right, we get to vote on it.
Yeah.
It's what people think about it.
If the majority deems it something that
right.
we want, then we do it.
Right, and that is what democracy is. If 51% say it, then that's what the law becomes. Matt?
I mean, social consensus is broke down as literally peer pressure.
Yeah.
The majority around you are doing it, therefore you should do it because the majority are doing it.
Right. Right.
That's very basic. It was criticized by even Aristotle. Democracy was criticized as being morally wrong.
Right. As if, because the masses, the masses are always right.
Right.
It's civilized mob mentality.
That's how you got
it. Yeah. Did you have something over here? And then I'll get to you, Ben.
Secular worldview is very. Looks very inclusive from the outside, but when you go inside, it's very exclusive. And the gospel from the outside looks very exclusive, but when you go into it, it's very inclusive.
Oh, that's a good.
And you see this here: the social reformers would not be moral after all, but rather more outcasts. So once they go inside, they go to change the system. No longer are they inclusive as they preach on the outside; they are now exclusive.
Right.
They never change what they're going on.
That's good. And this would also imply then that what Martin Luther King was doing was wrong. Oh, you were going to bring it? Okay. Gandhi, what Gandhi was doing was wrong, stuff like that. So you can't really go with that either. What time are we at? I'm trying to figure out if we should talk about social contract theory.
You've got 15 minutes.
We have 15 minutes,
no.
Okay.
Ten minutes. 10 minutes.
Do you guys want to get in? Have you guys heard of social contract theory? Okay. So Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And Thomas Hobbes both were like old famous people that wrote about social contract, and it's called a theory. Keep that in mind. Social contract theory is the idea that if everybody in a society can agree that they're concerned with each other's well-being, then that's where morality comes from, is that we tap into something within us that's good, and then we all pitch in to help each other. Would you say that that's a good characterization? Okay. So, what does that sound like to you? Everybody pitches in for each other, because everybody's got this innate goodness within them.
Kind of sounds like socialism or communism.
Yeah.
But they want them to be.
Yeah. But if everybody was inherently like kind of like everybody agreed to really be there and help each other and all that kind of stuff, does that sound like a good idea? Kind of sounds a little bit like the church, or a little bit like heaven. But this is called a theory. So I asked some of the atheists that I studied with, like, has there ever been a nation that actually has successfully done social contract theory? And because it's a theory, they said, well, no, it's just a really good idea. But the closest nation that has ever done it would be the United States, because of what the Constitution says about every human being and all that kind of stuff. So social contract theory, the only place you're going to find that, a taste of it is going to be in the church, where Jesus has taught the right kind of ethics. Because, like Thomas Paine would say in Common Sense, because wickedness is innate in human beings, you need a government. If social contract theory were possible, you would not need a government. It would be anarchy in the positive sense of the word. All right, I don't know.
Just a question. I mean, from all the things we've talked about so far in the class, in addition to tonight, I mean, the whole, so far, the study, it seems like it would be sometimes a difficult conversation to be able to have with an atheist unless they were at an emotional crossroads of some kind.
Yes.
And ready to challenge because there's so much evidence.
Yes.
Well, like you said when you started class tonight, I mean, the scales are tipped so heavy on the side of grounding and foundation and Christianity. And,
right.
You know, compared to, you can't, it all falls through your fingers.
Right. Well, so like last night I had a study with an atheist. I've never studied with an atheist who is like so entrenched in science that he's never thought about philosophy. Like most of the atheists I've studied with, they've also read some philosophy, and so they've been tempered a little bit by the people that are challenging science. This guy's straight science all the way. So like I asked him, like, well, where does your sense of meaning come from? We talked about meaning last night. And the quote from Leo Tolstoy about like he had to think like a drunk person, you guys remember that quote? Like as long as he could think like an intoxicated drunk person and not think about the deeper questions about what's left over after I die, he could be happy. But as soon as those nagging thoughts and deep questions came, he's like, what is the point of life? And then it drove him to become a believer in God and the Bible. I don't know. He's probably wrong about a lot of things. But it at least drove him to some idea of God. Our problem in our society is that we're busy amusing ourselves where we're not thinking deeply about why am I concerned about morality? Like, what is the grounding for it? Where is my sense of identity coming from, like we talked about last week? Where is my meaning being derived from? And these are things that Christians got to think about too.
Amen.
And so, all right, so those are some things to say about the secular grounding for morality. I want to then, with the time that we have left here, talk about the biblical approach to morality.
7 minutes.
7 minutes, all right, well, we can do this. So, what we're arguing here is, what Jim had brought up, I remember something else I wanted to say about that. When you're having these discussions with skeptics, you're essentially telling them your worldview fails to give you a real meaning in life. Your worldview fails to give you a sense of identity that can really sustain difficulties in life. Your worldview does not give you a reason to be concerned with morality. You're stripping something away from somebody if they have ears to hear. And that's why you always have to replace it with the biblical approach. So what we're trying to say here is your materialistic worldview gives you no real good reason to be concerned with morality. The Christian worldview has got better resources to have you concerned with morality, but look at this question. Some will point out that Christians are often hypocritical, so to suggest that Christianity offers better resources to be moral seems laughable. How would you answer this objection?
I would say the Bible offers better resources to be moral. And then, from that point, pivot it into the New Testament and Christianity and how that would, how it's supposed to use those resources. Just because there are better resources doesn't mean they're being used properly. For example, you could, you know, because you have a lot of money doesn't mean you're spending it for good causes.
Exactly. Or can have you ever, there's a family, a house, a husband and wife in Santee where I used to preach. And they weren't Christians, but I had a couple conversations with them. Everybody knew that they were multimillionaires. They drove like a 1997 Toyota Camry. Like, they did not dress up really well, but they were multimillionaires. You could say that they're not using their resources. Could you be a could you have all of the spiritual blessings in Christ but never utilize what you have? Yeah. And then eventually you wouldn't have them at all. But here's my point to this. Nobody is totally consistent with their worldview. Nobody is. The atheist cares about morality. That's not consistent with your worldview. I'm glad that you do, by the way, but that's not consistent with your worldview. In fact, you have to believe in morality by faith. For the Christian, are you guys always totally consistent with your worldview? No, nobody is. So if that's going to be the standard by which we determine if something's right and wrong, then nothing is true, because nobody lives up totally to their worldview. Does that make sense? All right, so that's a dumb thing to say. All right, so here's, I think, one of the best passages in the Bible to explain where Christians get their sense of morality. Genesis 1:27, so God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. All right. Let's say that, here's the clicker. Let's say that there's like a nail sticking up here and I started hitting the nail down and this thing shatters, so I contact whatever company made this. Anyway, you guys make terrible clickers. And like, well, what were you doing with it? Well, I was trying to use it as a hammer. Well, that's not the purpose of it. So how can you determine if something's good or bad if you don't know what its purpose is? For a skeptic to say, well, that person's a good person and that person's a bad person, you don't even know why we're here. How do you get the right to say who's good, what's good and bad, morally speaking, making value judgments about people, when you don't even know why we're here? If you don't know the purpose of man, then you don't know what a good or bad man or woman is. Does that make sense? All right, so based on that line of reasoning, how does this verse provide a clear purpose for mankind? You're made in God's image. What does that mean for your purpose?
We reflect his characteristics.
Yeah, we reflect his character. We talked about that some in the class on meaning. But the follow-up to this, to add to our class on meaning, is then where does ethical grounding come from for the Christian? If it can't be in morality, if it can't be in common sense, if it can't be in social consensus or social contract theory, where does ethical grounding come from? God. Is it even what God says? It's God's character, which we know from what he says. But our sense of morality, we love because what? He first loved us. Be holy for what? I am holy. Walk in love as Christ loved you. Forgive as what? As Christ has forgiven you. So our ethical grounding comes from God's character. And so therefore, the only kind of person who can truly have a good sense of morality is somebody who can draw near to God and understand who he is, and then therefore imitate the one that they were made in the image of. Does this seem pretty murky, or is this pretty clear? This, like, all these different debates about social contract theory and social consensus, and it comes from evolution, but even if morality does come from evolution, where's the code? Where's the codices, or where are the overall arching laws that evolution has created? There's still disagreements. It's all murky and ugly. But then if we know that, okay, we know what's right and wrong because we understand our purpose, which the materialist can't understand what their purpose is in any objective sense. In a personal sense, they could try to figure that out, but not in an objective sense. And so then that leads into our ethical grounding coming from God's character. And as we draw near to God, we can know what's right and wrong. That's a lot simpler than all of these other things that people try to work through. Any thoughts or comments on that?